You're listening to Spellbound.
Welcome to episode 19 of Spellbound. I'm Julian Smith. Spellbound is now a CastBox original. You can still listen to it anywhere else you typically listen to podcasts, but check out CastBox today and see what's making it the fastest growing and highest rated podcast app on both iOS and Android. All right, I'm here with Lara Boroditsky. Lara, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
I discovered you through your TED Talk on language and how it affects pretty much everything.
The way we think.
Yeah, it's a pretty big deal. Mm-hmm. I'll go ahead and set you up a little bit. You are a cognitive scientist, UC San Diego professor, and a leading contributor to the theory of linguistic relativity, which argues that language shapes our perception of reality. You have a bachelor's in cognitive science from Northwestern, a PhD in cognitive psychology from Stanford. You've even been called one of 25 visionaries changing the world.
It's a tall order. The world is a hard place to change.
So I loved your TED Talk on language. The whole nature of this podcast is about how words can affect how we think about everything. And so we have a lot of people on here just talking about different ideas, but you're the first person to come actually talk about language. So here we are talking about language with language.
Wonderful.
Here we are.
Language allows us to do that.
So what kind of person studies language for a living?
Someone who's curious, someone who likes things that are structured and messy at the same time.
So what made you curious about words?
I grew up in the Soviet Union and I came to the United States when I was 12. And so the first experience you have when your context changes so much, you start noticing all the things that people in your old life used to believe to be absolutely true that people in your new life don't believe and vice versa. And there's a very clear disconnect between how certain people are of the reality that they believe in and how certain the other people are of a very different reality. So that made me first question how much of what we believe to be true is socially constructed and constructed by our culture and narrative. And then I was a very argumentative kid. So I would get into lots of political arguments with people.
As a kid, the political arguments.
Well, you know, I was a serious child. And I started noticing that a lot of the arguments that I was in centered around some particular word or set of words that was being used by different people. So I might be talking about freedom, but I mean one thing, and you're also talking about freedom, but you mean something else. And so we can't actually ever come to an agreement because we're using those words in different ways. And at that stage, I thought, well, maybe what I need to do is study language so that I can find the true meanings of these words. And if I find the true meanings of these words, then we can settle this argument about truth or freedom or justice or whatever it is that we're talking about. And so that was one of the things that made me want to study language. But of course, when you actually study language and the way natural languages work, you realize there is no such thing as a true meaning of a word like freedom or justice or truth. Instead, there are all these different uses. And so my original goal in studying language has been a complete failure. But along the way, I've discovered some really interesting ways in which we construct reality, in which we come to see the world the way that we do.
Well, I don't know your story very well because we've just met, but it wouldn't seem fair to call it a complete failure because what you've done is you've opened this Pandora's box of something much deeper than you intended to find is what I would probably say.
Well, you know, in science, you're never really answering a question. Every time you come close to answering a question, what you're doing is opening lots and lots of other questions. So it's a pretty normal thing that the most important product of any scientific investigation is learning just how little we actually understand.
Right.
And how many more things we have yet to study. So I think in this field, just like any other, you start out with a simple question like, does language shape thought? It's even framed as a yes or no question. What could be simpler? And then it turns out things are much more complicated and much more interesting than that. So a lot of time can be occupied asking all the different versions of those questions.
So what is linguistic relativity and why is it such a big deal?
The basic idea is that the languages we speak shape the way we think. So languages differ in their structures. There are about 7,000 languages spoken around the world, and they differ in all kinds of ways. Of course, we know they have different words and they have different sounds, but they also differ they're also different in their structures. And so the question is whether the structures of the languages that we speak actually influence the way we see the world, whether in some ways they're shaping how we pay attention to what we're, how we remember the world, how we reason, how we make decisions, all of that stuff. And I think of it as more of a hypothesis than a claim, because there's so many different ways in which languages can differ, and there's so many different things they could possibly affect. So it's a way of approaching studying the role that language plays in cognition.
Yeah, so a human comes into the world a blank slate, knowing no words, knowing no definitions, only really understanding, I guess, instincts like fear and love and things like that. So words are, you know, I guess when you break it down like that, words kind of seem like, is it conditioning? Is that what you would call it? Is it fair to call it conditioning?
So I would actually challenge the way you described a way a human comes into the world, because by the time an infant is born, they've already been exposed to language for a long time because they're hearing in the womb. And so newborn infants, for example, are sensitized to the sounds of their language, and they can distinguish them from the sounds of other languages that they're unfamiliar with. But the visual world is new to them. So very often people do think about, oh, they're infants when they're born, they have all this visual information, but they don't yet speak a language, so they don't have any language. But actually, you start learning language before you are ever exposed to any visual information. So it's there from the very, very beginning. And also with ideas like fear and love, it really depends on, those are of course words we're using in English. So to say an infant is born with an understanding of fear or love, boy, it's really hard to prove that to be true, especially with something like love. You know, what would be a physiological definition of love that you could show an infant has? Of course, there are different cultural ideas of love from place to place, and the way that word get translated to different languages will also be different. So very definitely an infant is born with some predispositions and also a little bit of experience, and they continue to acquire experience as they keep going, and visual experience, physical motion experience, language experience, those are all happening for them at the same time, and they're all intertwined. And so our brains are very good at melding those together and allowing different sources of information to inform each other to try to make sense of how to actually act in the world. And the structures that you have in your particular language are structures that were built by thousands of generations of people before you who found those structures useful or interesting for some reason. And so those structures are coming in as an extra guidebook to help you focus on the things that other people think are important to focus on, help you pay attention to the things that will be useful to, that have been deemed useful by other people in your culture to pay attention to. And so it just becomes one of the many streams of experience that you have.
So you don't think people are born with a capacity for fear and love? I mean, what about like the reptilian mind and the neocortex and the limbic system? Isn't that just part of our evolution?
It really depends on what you mean by fear and love, especially when we're talking about something like love, which is very abstract and very complex. There's no such thing as an infant version of love that's going to be the same as the adult version of love as it's manifested in all of the different forms that it happens across cultures, across time, across different situations in which people feel love for one another. And even take a word like love in English, you know, I can say that I love my mother. I can say that I love my partner. I could say that I love cabbage. Those are all different forms of love, right? So to say that there's some biological primitive that underlies all of these, I think is quite a tall claim. And even with some things that are more primitive, like fear, there are certainly a set of physiological responses and brain responses that correspond with the English word fear. But there are also lots of things that we call fear that don't evoke those physiological responses. And there are also lots of physiological responses that are similar to fear that we don't cause us to be afraid, right? And so the relationship between the basic physiology and the psychology is much less linear and much more complex than it sometimes seems it should be.
I know we're not here to talk about fear and love, but I think it's an interesting starting point for the conversation because we're talking about how words influence so much. Love, you're right, you have to define it, but I guess what I'm saying is through our evolution, we are, we're part mammal. So we're built, we have the built-in capacity.
I would say we're all mammal.
Well, yeah, we're all mammal, but we're more than mammal because we have human self-awareness and we're mammal by definition, but we're not, we're more than that in our minds, I guess what I'm getting at. I mean, that's accurate, right?
Sure. Our cognitive systems allow us to go well beyond what's available to us in our physical experience, right? So that's actually quite an important puzzle for cognitive science, that we are these physical creatures. So we get physical signals from the world. We get photons in our eyes and pressure waves impinging on our eardrums. And we feel pressure and gravity from outside surfaces. And we get molecules on our noses and on our tongues. And then we can exert force on the world. So we can bend our toes and flex our knees to try to defy gravity and move around. We can make pressure waves in the air to communicate with one another and do things like that. And then somehow all of these physical things that we do yield these very abstract ideas that we end up with, like truth, justice, principles, goals. These aren't things that you can see or smell or touch or feel in any perceptual way. So how is it that human minds go beyond that physical, those simple set of physical experiences to actually create all of these things? Like, how do we come up with ideas like time travel or imaginary numbers? Or how do we reason about invisible forces like physicists do? This is actually a puzzle that Darwin was faced with when he was formulating the theory of evolution, because he was arguing that any capacity could be explained by some prior evolutionary advantage. And Wallace, who was the co-originator of the theory of evolution alongside Darwin, wrote him a letter saying he was ready to give up on the theory of evolution because he started thinking about how do we come up with these abstract ideas. And he said, there's no way that a brain that evolved for locomotion and all of these basic functions could play chess or write symphonies or do any of these fancy things. And Darwin had to write him a letter and talk him down. He said, I hope you haven't murdered completely your own child and mine. He said something like that. And then explained that, of course, things that have evolved for one purpose can be exapted or reused or recycled for some other purpose. And so the hardware that we're using for writing symphonies or playing chess or thinking about quantum physics didn't evolve for that purpose, but it is hardware that we can use for that purpose. So it's being, you know, it may have evolved for basic locomotion and basic perception, but now we're reusing it for these higher purposes.
So do you believe that we need fear to a certain extent, that it's helpful? Do you believe that we need companionship and that it's helpful and that we're evolved to need those things?
Well, it's hard to imagine if you didn't have fear, you would have a different set of creatures, right? And you would live in a different kind of world. So the question of do you need it is relative to some set of goals, right? So do you need fear? Is it useful in some circumstances to the current world that we live in? Sure, of course. You can come up with ways in which all the features that we have are useful in some set of circumstances. But if by do you need, you mean, would it be impossible to have organisms that don't experience fear? I don't think that's true. I think you could have organisms that don't experience fear. They would just live in a different world and be adapted to a different set of circumstances. In fact, there are humans that don't experience fear. So if you have damage to your amygdala, you'll not be able to feel the experience of fear. You might know that something threatening is about to happen, but it'll be in this cold, dispassionate way. You won't actually feel fear in your body.
Interesting.
And so those people survive and they just have a really different experience than we do.
So what goes into researching linguistic relativity? What does your work look like when you're testing people and trying to get responses to test this? What does it look like?
Well, often we start with an observation about how languages differ. So you learn about some language that does something that seems so basic and universal to you. And then you say, wait, what? They don't do that. They do something completely different. And right. You get excited about that. And you start thinking about what might it mean for how people think. And then you construct a test. And the most fun thing is when you get to go somewhere and you've, you know, planned this experiment and you lay out a basic task in front of people and you get to see someone act in a way that you've never seen someone act before. So you thought this is just a basic function of humans. It's just how humans have to be. And then you go and see with your own eyes that it can be different. Let me just give you a couple of examples. And this is one of the reasons that I'm suspicious about claims like, you know, we're born with an idea of love or things like that, because we can always come up with reasons for why whichever way we feel in the moment is the right way.
I can just clarify what I meant by that before you go into that, I'm not saying that we're born understanding love or understanding fear. Obviously, we have to experience those things before we know how we're going to react or what it feels like. But I was suggesting that before mammals were even on the planet, it was survival. Everything was survival. Reptilians were just, there was no capacity for relationships. So to a certain extent, it seems fair to say that we've evolved to become relational creatures. No?
Maybe, I don't know.
Don't think so?
It's certainly true now about humans that we're very social creatures. And it's one of the very special things about our species is just how social we are and how much we learn from each other and how much knowledge we pass on to each other. But I don't know. I don't know that it's a matter of being mammals or not mammals. That maybe is just outside of my scope of expertise. Any simple system can show aversion and can show affiliation. All right. Even a magnet will behave to an outside observer as if it's attracted to something and repelled by other things. And so if you're analyzing it at a certain level, you could say, hey, this is a creature that loves some things and hates other things, even though when you understand the physics, you wouldn't necessarily ascribe those mental states to it. So that's the reason I keep pushing back on that idea, yeah, is that there are many different levels at which you can understand attraction and repulsion, fear and love. And you can observe things that look like those behaviors in very, very simple systems. Like, yeah, what actually is love? Can you give me the definition? Can you really say that you know for sure when you're feeling it? Like, is it a state? Is it an emotion? Is it a set of thoughts? But it's so common for people to say, well, of course, love is universal. And I always feel like, well, there must be something broken with me. Well, I just don't know what it is.
When I was talking about love earlier, I was talking not so much about romanticism, but love in the sense of, like, you wouldn't even call it love looking at the way pack animals travel together, but they are very egalitarian and yet there's still like structure and order, but there's a definite companionship there. You know, we wouldn't call it love because we have romanticism and it's been the dominant idea of love since it came around. But before then, before romanticism was around, people probably would look at pack animals and say that that was a form of love.
Hmm. And would you look at, you know, sand grains forming a particular pattern as a result of being hit by the water a particular way and say that's a form of love that they've like stuck together and made this pattern?
No, because the sand has no intent.
But how do you know that the pack animals have intent? And what is their intent? Maybe their intent is something completely different than caring about each other at all. I mean, it's always poking at these very kind of deep questions. I always make this joke when I talk about you know, how complicated words are and how they defy definition. I always make this joke to my students that, you know, if someone asks you, "Do you love me?" the right answer is, well, you know, as Wittgenstein shows in the Philosophical Investigations, words are just tools we use in context and they can change meaning.
Blah, right. Blah, blah.
You shouldn't say that. You should say whatever you need to say in that context. But just, you know, you can think it and have that be the right answer in your mind. But I use that example specifically because people place so much emphasis on some specific words, right? So like justice, what is just, or freedom, you know, what is really freedom? And so we have so much time worrying about those things, and the definitions of those things cause so much conflict. And especially, you know, if someone says they love someone and then the other person doesn't say it back, or when people say, well, I love you, but I'm not in love with you, or they could, you know, try to parse all of these things. We treat those things as if they have some kind of connection to Platonic truths, like they're reaching out into the heavens. And
I know what you're talking about. Really
connecting to a real object, but they're not.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. And it's those heavy things that make for the most contentious disagreements, because I don't think you can really know what someone means when they say they feel free or they feel love or things like that.
Okay. So you were going to give an example on what testing linguistic relativity looks like.
Sure. When I started doing research on how we think about time, there are a couple of things that had been observed very robustly about how American English speakers think about time. And I say American English speakers, but actually we believed that this is how humans thought about time. We just only ever tested American English speakers because they're conveniently located. So there are two things that were true. One is that we put the future in front and the past is behind us. So we say things in English like the best is ahead of us, the worst is behind us. And this was argued to be necessarily true because, of course, we have eyes on the front of our heads and not on the back of our heads, and we move forwards much more so than we move backwards. It just seemed to be some kind of biological requirement that the future would be in front. The other thing that we knew to be true is that time proceeded from left to right. So if you watch the way people gesture when they're talking about, I'm going to do this thing, and then I'm going to do the next thing, and so on, they'll gesture things from left to right, putting earlier things on the left and later things on the right. And people argue that this had to do with asymmetries in the brain. So there's something about the fact that our left hemisphere and our right hemisphere aren't the same. And of course, most people are right-handed, not left-handed. So there was a set of explanations, again, based on biology and the structure of the body, that were supposed to explain why these things had to be true. But then as you go around the world, you start seeing patterns that are completely different. So in fact, people who read and write languages that go from right to left lay out time from right to left and not left to right. And it's not because their brains are structured differently with respect to the two hemispheres, and it's not because they're all left-handed. It's just a matter of a cultural practice of organizing things from left to right or right to left. And there are cultures that put the past in front and the future behind. So when they're talking about the past, they'll gesture in front of them. And when they're talking about the future, they'll gesture behind them. This is some wonderful work by Rafael Nunez and Yves Switzer with the Aymara. And the reason it makes sense for the Aymara to put the past in front is that the past is known. It's manifest. So you already know what happened, whereas the future is unknown. That's why it's behind your head. You can't see it.
Right.
And so that to me is the beginning of showing how human minds are actually incredibly flexible. They're much more flexible than we give ourselves credit for. We can come up with all kinds of ways of organizing our mental lives, and we can come up with reasons for why the way that we do it is the right way and the way that makes the most sense. And once you inhabit that world, you say, oh yeah, that does actually make sense. I never would have thought to do it that way. But it's those little moments in my research that I find the most pleasurable, when you discover something about how someone else does it. And it feels like discovering a whole new conceptual world where you're like, oh, wow, I never would have thought to do it that way. But it actually does totally make sense. And boy, humans are so clever everywhere. They have come up with all of these things.
The interesting thing about looking at words the way that linguistic relativity does is it does strip away a lot. It does take away a lot. So you're kind of left with this very existential dilemma with, like, what does anything mean? I mean, we've spent probably half of this podcast so far just talking about whether or not animals love each other and what is love, you know? I really do think that, I mean, I feel like I have intent. I think I feel like you would say you have intent. I mean, I can definitely intend to hurt somebody, and I can intend to make somebody feel good.
These are all very complicated questions that you're raising. Even knowing what you feel like you have intent, is that a real thing or is that an illusion? Right. So there's a lot of research that goes into what actually is that sense of intent. To what extent, when you feel intent, has your brain already done the thing that it's going to do? And only later does it tell you that you had the intent to do that.
Right. You're saying we're basically living in a simulation or something.
Well, there's a real difference between what your brain and body is doing and what is made available to your consciousness, and also what interpretation you put on what is made available to your consciousness, right? So there are many, many layers of interpretation that you're already putting on something that you're experiencing as intent.
Do you want to give me something slightly less opaque than that? I mean, is this interesting to you in talking about like this stuff on this level? I mean, we're here to talk about words, but we could go into this for a couple more minutes if you want. I mean, it's interesting to me because this is what lies underneath words, you know?
Well, let me bring it back to words. When we're having this discussion, we're using, of course, words to have this discussion, right? And we are talking about intent as if it's a real thing. We're talking about love as if it's a real thing, as if it's a real physical object. And whenever you try to dig into any one of these things as a scientist, you have to say, what are the measurable physical things that I would have to go in and measure that would be my operational definition of intent, my operational definition of love, my operational definition of fear? And that's actually the work that all experimental psychologists do. Whatever behavior you want to study, let's say you want to study attention, right? And so then you say, okay, attention is a word in English, but what am I actually going to measure? And then you make certain tasks that people can perform, and those become your operational definitions of attention. And some of these things, once you measure them in experiments, are more stable, easier to measure, easier to define. The definitions that you come up with seem more like actually what we mean by attention in colloquial use. And some things are really, really hard, right? So ultimately, the battle for any scientist is to try to get beyond the words, because, you know, words are just these things that we've inherited culturally, and instead say, how can we actually ground this in some kind of physical measurement that we can make in a way that still speaks to things that we care about? Right? So always the work of a scientist is to say, let's not argue about the words, but let's try to come up with some much more concrete physical operational definitions where other people can then go and measure the same things and the same tasks. And then we can come up with a rich enough repertoire of tasks that we feel like we've gathered some real knowledge about how this particular mental function works. And then actually, once you've done that, it makes very little sense to argue about, is it intent? Is it not intent? That becomes this kind of silly thing that you can do afterwards, because really what you've done is characterized a whole bunch of mental capacities, and what word you apply to them doesn't much matter.
Yeah, but you have to mobilize somehow. I mean, I understand what you're talking about. You're talking about this on a very deep level. You're saying that once you take the words away, there's not much. And then once you go even deeper into that, there's even less. But no matter what you think about what this world is, whether you think we're just here on some rock that's going to, you know, burn up one day and then nothing will be here, or whether you think we're in a computer simulation, or whether you think we're going to get reincarnated, or whether you think we're going somewhere after we die, whatever you think of this place, you have to have some form of action with your existence. Otherwise, why are you living right now? Why don't you just go live under a rock or kill yourself or something? Like, you have to have some kind of intent. Like, you have to have something behind your actions, right?
Well, you certainly believe that you have intent. Let me make this problem maybe more concrete or more annoying. Even a word like, let's take a word like chair, right? So of course you say, well, of course we all know what a chair is. But if I ask you to define what a chair is, I don't know, how would you define a chair?
In the terms under which we're speaking, or in modern English?
In English, yeah. Like, what's a chair?
Yeah, it has four legs, typically made of wood or stainless steel or some cheap plastic, and you can sit on it and it helps you relax.
Okay. So if we take any one part of that definition that you just gave, which is a perfectly fine, you give a perfectly fine attempt.
Thank you.
But there are lots of chairs, lots of things that we call chairs that don't have four legs. Some don't have legs at all. So for example, beanbag chairs don't have legs at all. Wheelchairs, are wheels legs or not? And yeah, I can show you millions and millions of examples of things that we have agreed to call chairs that don't have four legs or don't have legs at all, or they hang and they don't actually sit on the ground. And
it's a relaxation device.
Well, okay. So if you just want to say that it's a relaxation device, then actually that the problem there is that it's not exclusive enough. So lots and lots of things are relaxation devices, right? So if I give you a piece of plastic that you can squeeze, that's also a relaxation device, but you wouldn't call it a chair, right? A nice martini is a relaxation device, but again, you wouldn't call it a chair. And so once you start trying to define even a really simple physical thing like a chair, you find that whatever definition you come up with fails on two counts. One is it's not inclusive enough, that whatever definition you come up with will exclude lots and lots of things that we think are perfectly good chairs. And it's also not exclusive enough. It will rule in all kinds of things that are definitely not chairs. So for example, you know, you can sit on it. Well, you can sit on lots of things. You can sit on a couch. You can sit on the ground. You can sit on a bicycle. You can sit on an elephant. You can sit on your grandmother. But not all of those things are chairs, right? And also there are plenty of chairs that you can't sit on for a variety of reasons. So even when you take a simple thing like the word chair and say, let's come up with a definition, a set of necessary and sufficient features for a chair, you run into problems. Imagine how difficult it is when you very seriously consider something like intent or something like love, and you try to come up with a really good scientific physical definition of those things. So we just had trouble with chair. And right. So whenever you engage with these concepts, and you absolutely should, and that is the work of experimental psychology and a lot of philosophy, and there are really fascinating debates and arguments that happen around these ideas, but they're just so much more complicated than that word, that initial engagement with the word suggests, right? You think that because you have a word for it, you understand something about it. You have some, it's like an object that you can grasp. But as soon as you actually try to have an understanding of it, it becomes so much more interesting and complicated than that.
Let's put a pin right there. We're going to take a break to talk about the people who made this episode possible. I'm talking about HelloFresh. HelloFresh is a meal kit delivery service that shops, plans, and delivers step-by-step recipes and pre-measured ingredients so you can just cook, eat, and enjoy. There's a little something for everyone with HelloFresh's selection. Each box is made up of fresh, responsibly obtained ingredients from carefully selected farms and trusted sources. Rediscover the excitement of cooking. Look forward to your HelloFresh delivery knowing dinner just got that much easier. HelloFresh believes cooking should be simple and convenient, not a chore. All ingredients come in these handy little pre-labeled meal kits so you know which ingredients go with which meal. There's many perks of subscribing so you can keep enjoying HelloFresh week after week. Get out of that recipe rut and start cooking outside your comfort zone by discovering new, delicious recipes in each week's box. I personally enjoyed the pesto panko chicken dish. Apologies to all of my listeners. I am not 100% vegan. I'm sorry. The Yukon potatoes were quite good. I'm a sucker for potatoes. Don't call me cheap. Get $30 off your first week of HelloFresh by visiting HelloFresh.com/spell30 and enter the coupon code SPELL30. That's HelloFresh.com/SPELL30, coupon code SPELL30. So yeah, I totally get it. Yeah, there is no spoon. There's nothing. Yeah, when you really dig into this stuff, there's nothing.
Well, there are things that we agree to call spoons.
Right. Kind of like we agree a dollar is worth a dollar, but at the end of the day, there's no gold backing it.
It's a social convention. There's a set of social conventions that make things true when those social conventions apply. Yes.
You know, obviously every language is structured really differently and there's tons of different languages and it would be impossible for any one person to be fluent in every language because it's just too broad and there's too many. So is it fair to call language a reduction system for reality or something like that?
Certainly language is a very sparse code of our experience, right? So if I tell you it rained earlier today, which happens to be true, I'm telling you only a tiny proportion of what I know about the situation. So you're not, for example, thinking, oh boy, she doesn't know that it only rained outdoors and not inside this house, because she didn't say that. She only said it rained, right? So I've told you something that is, you know, reasonably corresponds to reality, but it's only a tiny proportion of what I actually know. And I could know lots more things. Like I could know that the raindrops were relatively small and not too warm, and maybe that there'll be chanterelles in East County as a result. You know, I could know lots and lots of things about that experience, But usually what we communicate in language is just a very, very sparse coding of the experience. So definitely whatever we put in language is going to be a greatly reduced and categorized form of the experience. We'll take even a simple example like words for colors. Of course, there's a continuous color spectrum that we are sensitive to, all these different wavelengths of colors. But then we categorize them into some small number of discrete categories. So there are a bunch of things that we call blue. Well, they're all different wavelengths that go into the category blue, but we say, that's close enough. we'll call them blue, right?
Because we're lazy Americans.
Well, it's a reduction. Any category in language is a reduction. So the same with going back to the chair example. There's just one word, but can cover millions and millions of different artifacts that all look different, that were made at different times, made out of different stuff. So of course, it's an abstraction and a simplification, but it's a useful abstraction in lots of cases.
It almost seems like there's so much more to existence than words let us get to. Like if we weren't confined to thinking in the way our languages that we speak force us to see everything, then is there any knowledge that we have about like how much bigger our worldview would be or how differently we would see things?
Well, so I don't think language really confines us necessarily in the sense that we can't think outside of the bounds of our language. It's just that we don't often think to try. Right. So you can learn about other ways that people think that go beyond your language. And you can also certainly notice things that are beyond your language. So just because you call all the different shades of blue, blue, doesn't mean that you can't tell that one blue is different from another. Right. You can still see them as different shades. Or let me give you a silly example. In Finnish, there are no gender markings. So there's no distinction between he and she made. But I have it on pretty good authority that Finns have managed to procreate for many generations and not just by randomly bumping into one another and, you know, once in a while a happy accident occurs. They've figured out that they're biologically different kinds of people and there's a way to create new people and so on. And so just because there isn't that distinction in their language, it doesn't mean they don't make that distinction in all kinds of other ways, right? So language isn't a hard limit on your thinking. It's very easy to come up with examples where we see a lot more than we tend to code in language. But it is a guidebook. It creates a set of habits or patterns that you're most likely to take rather than seeing things in all of the other ways that you could possibly see them. But it's certainly possible to imagine things that go beyond your language. That's one of the ways that we build new structures into language in the first place, right? So languages are always changing. We're always adapting them to suit our needs. And usually it's because someone is thinking about something that doesn't already exist in the language and they want language to be a better tool to express their thoughts. And so they try to build that thing in and sometimes succeed. So to make it maybe simple, there's pluses and minuses to any coding scheme you have. Any form of representation, whether it's language or musical notation or a programming language or whatever, there are going to be ways in which the simplifications make you efficient. There are ways in which they allow you to see underlying structure that might be obscured by all kinds of details otherwise. There are all kinds of benefits to any representational scheme you choose. And then there are also drawbacks to any representational scheme you choose. There are going to be gross oversimplifications. You're going to think that things that are called by the same name are more similar than they really are, and things that are called by different names are more different than they really are. So there are going to be exaggerations that happen around any form of representation you choose, whether it's language or any other kind of notation.
You were talking about time mm-hmm. and how people describe time based on the language they speak and whether it's, you know, left to right or right to left. Mm-hmm. Time goes in all different directions depending on what you think. That's kind of an abstract representation of how language can affect your perception of reality. Are there any like concrete examples of how it can affect your memory of how something went down or a perception of something that you're looking at right in front of you? Can language affect things like that?
Sure. So let me give you an example of looking at something that's right in front of you. I already mentioned that languages divide up the color spectrum differently. So some languages have lots of words for colors. Some languages have only a couple words like light and dark. And where languages place boundaries across colors differs from language to language. So for example, my native language, Russian, makes an obligatory distinction between light blue and dark blue. So there's not a single word that covers all of the colors that English calls blue. Instead, there's a light blue, Golubой, and a dark blue, Синий. And so Russian speakers have a lifetime of experience of distinguishing between light blues and dark blues. And when you test Russian speakers and English speakers on just their ability to say which colors are same or different, you see that Russian speakers are faster actually at saying that two shades of blue are different if they fall on different sides of the light blue, dark blue boundary in Russian, right? So if you have one color that's Golubой and another that's Синий, that is categorically different for the Russian speakers and they're faster to say they're different. Whereas for English speakers, they're not categorically different. They're both just blue. And that's an example where you're looking at the colors. They're all present right in front of you, right in front of your eyes. And the decision that you're making is a very simple one. And when you look at the colors, it feels like you just know immediately that they're the same or different. It doesn't seem like a hard task. Like if you're a pigeon, you could do that task. It's not difficult. You certainly don't need language. And yet the experience you've had with language sneaks in and meddles even in that very low level, very simple decision that feels like this very basic perceptual decision. I'll give you another example from memory. You asked about memory. Languages talk about events very differently. So for example, when we talk about accidents in English, there's this funny thing that we do where we can use the very same construction to talk about something, whether it's an accident or not. So if I want to break a glass, I grab it, I smash it in anger on the ground. You could say, I broke the glass. But if I just knock into it and it falls and smashes and I didn't mean to do it, it's still perfectly fine in English to say, I broke the glass. In fact, you can say in English things like, I broke my arm, even though, of course, most of the time you didn't intend to break your arm.
But what is intent?
Well, it could mean many different things. So actually, let me break it out more. In English, we can say he drank the poison for the following three scenarios. If Romeo drinks the poison, so from Romeo and Juliet, Romeo intends to drink the poison. He knows he's drinking the poison. He drinks it, right? So it's he knows that it's poison. He intends to do it. And he is creating this volitional physical action. Or take the example of Caesar. Caesar drank the poison. So Caesar thinks he's drinking wine, but someone has put poison in his cup. So he's intentionally drinking, but he doesn't know that what he's drinking is poison. He doesn't intend to drink poison, but he intends to drink. Right? Or take Socrates drank the poison. Socrates is being forced to drink hemlock. So he knows he's drinking poison, but he doesn't want to be. So he's not doing it volitionally. He's doing it under duress. Now, in all of those cases in English, you can say he drank the poison. But there are languages that will make a distinction between those three different situations. So in Divehi, for example, this is a language spoken in the Maldives, you would use three different grammatical constructions for those three different cases because they differ in whether you're doing it knowingly, whether you're doing it volitionally, whether you intend the physical action, or you intend the outcome. So there are all of these different distinctions that languages make. And what we find is that the distinctions that languages make and what they make you pay attention to when you witness an event change what you remember. So if you're an English speaker, you witness an event, you're very likely to remember who did it, even if it's an accident, because you're very likely to describe it as if he did it. He popped the balloon, he broke the glass, so on. Whereas if you speak a language that makes a stronger distinction between accidents and intentional actions, you're less likely to remember who did it because you're more likely to say something like the glass broke, but you're more likely to remember whether or not it was an accident because you know that you would have described those things differently. So that's an example where language changes what you attend to and what you remember. And so you have two people viewing exactly the same scene, but they just come from different linguistic backgrounds and they end up remembering different things about the experience because of the way they would normally talk about it in their language.
What implications does this have on eyewitness testimony?
Well, eyewitness testimony is extremely suspect anyway. We know that from lots and lots of work in cognitive psychology, our memories are extremely fallible and limited, and it's very easy to sway people's memory through language. So a classic set of experiments by Beth Loftus show people videos of cars in accidents. And later she asked them questions about the accidents. And she might ask you, how fast were the cars going when they contacted each other, or how fast were the cars going when they smashed into each other? And what she found was people gave really different speed estimates depending on the verb that you choose. So if you use this very vivid verb like smash, people would give speed estimates that were a lot higher than if you use a word like contacted or hit.
They're leading.
Yeah. But also a week later, if you ask people, did you see any broken glass? About a third of the people who were asked about how fast the cars were going when they smashed into each other, about a third of those people said they saw broken glass when there was no broken glass actually in the videos at all. And so just that verb, this very crunchy, vivid verb, implanted this idea of a much more vivid, exciting scene than people had actually witnessed. So it actually is very, very easy to implant these kinds of ideas and notions in people's memories. One thing I like to do in my classes when I teach memory is from the very first lecture, I start planting this idea that my cell phone rang during the first lecture. And so I say, if my cell phone were to ring now, and I go through all the different parts of the brain and what they would be doing and in response to all of these different things. And then slowly over the course of the class, I switch it from being a hypothetical, if my phone had rang, I say, when my phone rang. And then right before we start talking about memory, I give them a little memory quiz and I ask them, what do you remember about that first day of lecture? And do you remember when my phone rang? And do you remember what I was doing before and what I was doing after? And was I embarrassed and all of these things? And people have all different kinds of memories about my phone ringing. And so some people thought I was embarrassed and some people thought I wasn't embarrassed. They have all very vivid, detailed memories that, of course, disagree with one another. And about two-thirds of them actually say they remember when my phone rang, right? So It's a thing that didn't happen, but...
You planted it.
I very carefully implanted as an idea in their mind, and then... They remember not just the idea of my phone ringing, but also all kinds of details. Like, did I walk or run to my purse? Did I have to rummage for a while or not? Could they themselves hear my ringtone or not? So they have all these circumstantial memories of an event that didn't occur. And so it, to me, it's a really powerful demonstration of how constructive our memory is when we're remembering things we're not really playing back a videotape. We're constructing what might have happened from bits and pieces that have stored away. And some of those bits and pieces that we store away aren't of actual experiences, they're of imagined experiences. So when we talk about eyewitness testimony or even judgments that you can make about an event that you're watching, of course, many different things go into making those judgments. Language is one of them. Let me give you one example. We did a study. It was about the original wardrobe malfunction. Janet Jackson and Justin Timberlake performed at the Super Bowl halftime show. And then for, 9/16 of a second, her breast was partially exposed on television. And this caused incredible upset and uproar. People were so offended that it quickly became the most TiVo'd event in all of TiVo history. And there's...
Is that true?
Yeah, it was... I assume people TiVo'd it and rewatched it over and over again just because they were so offended. That can only be the explanation. So the FCC tried to fine CBS $550,000 for this indecency. So we use this event as a way of testing whether we could sway how people see an event like this and how much they blame and punish people, even when it's something that you've seen many times before, even if it's something you know a lot about. It was all over the news, so everyone had discussed it ad nauseum. And so we would watch, we would show people the video, which they had seen usually many times before, and then we would either describe it using agentive constructions, like in the final dance move, Timberlake slip the cover off her chest, or non-agentive construction, like in the final dance move, the cover slipped off her chest. Of course, they were seeing the very same video, right? And we even have these expressions in English where you say, well, let's go to the tape, as if going to the tape will show us the truth, will reveal to us the thing that really happened. But in this case, what we found was that people were seeing the same video, but if they were given these two different descriptions, they blamed Timberlake more if we said he slipped the cover off her chest, and they wanted to fine him 57% more in fines. It was a very expensive linguistic description for Timberlake if we put it on him in the description. And this was true even though everyone was looking at the same video. So this idea of, well, let's just go to the tape, let's just review what really happened, is an illusion that we have, right? There, obviously, there's some things that you can get from seeing the physical evidence, but a lot of things are interpretations that happen after the fact. Or a lot of things are things that we just aren't very good at perceiving in the physical world. So if I go back to the example of how fast were the cars going, in some of the videos, the cars were going slower or faster, so 10 miles, 20 miles, 30 miles an hour. But people were actually incredibly insensitive to the actual speed that the cars were going. So they gave about the same estimate regardless of how fast the cars were actually going, but they were strongly swayed by the language of the question. So if you said, how fast were they going when they smashed into each other, they gave a higher estimate than when they contacted each other. So that tells you that we're not that good at judging speed from the physical evidence.
Right.
So our judgments of speed then can be extremely variable based on all of these other cues that we get from language. So we think that we're seeing reality in front of us all the time. There's some things that we're just not equipped to see. And there's some things that just require a lot of interpretation, like who's to blame and how much to blame they are. But we have the illusion that we're directly perceiving it when in fact we're really constructing it in our minds.
So you can plant an idea in someone's head with language pretty easily, but can somebody's native language affect their perception of something that happened?
Sure. The language acts as a guide to what you are likely to pay attention to and what you're likely then to remember. So when we talk about events, for example, if you're more likely to say he broke the vase, then you're more likely to remember who did it. But if you're more likely to say the vase broke, you might be less likely to remember who did it, but you might be more likely to remember that it was an accident, for example. If your language makes a distinction between blue and green, for example, you'll be more likely to remember whether you saw a blue or a green than if your language calls them both by the same word. So there's lots of examples like that where your language makes a distinction, it's easier to remember differences across that distinction. But it's harder to remember differences within a category. So if I call both things blue, it's harder for me to remember which exact blue that I saw than if I call them by different names.
Is there something we could learn from this that would help our global scenario where people are, you know, there's so much division in the world right now? Is there something we can learn from this?
I think for me, the most important lesson is first accept that it's not just people elsewhere who are being shaped by their language and culture and think in funny ways because of their language and culture, but actually all of us are being shaped by the patterns in our language and culture. We inherit a huge amount from these social structures that are invisible to us. And so the way that you see the world is being shaped by these things that seem invisible to you, the language that you speak, the cultural practices that surround you. And so when you encounter someone that you disagree with, our first instinct usually is to think that we're right and they're wrong, right? Because we believe we perceive the world the way it really is. We see reality directly. And they're telling us something different. So they must not be perceiving reality correctly. And so the first instinct then is to say, okay, so they're wrong. It could be because they just haven't been exposed to the right facts. They're ignorant. And so if I just expose them to the right facts, then they'll see things my way. And if that doesn't work, then it's because they're biased. It's because they're incapable of seeing facts correctly. But we never entertain that the way we see things might also be shaped by our own set of biases and our history of experience and all of these different factors that go into creating the minds that we have. And so rather than approaching disagreements by trying to just change the mind of the other person, to turn the mirror on yourself and say, well, why is it that I think the things that I think? How do I know the things that I know? And actually openly engaging in a dialogue with someone who thinks something different from you is a really wonderful way to do a deep dive on your own ideas. We believe things blindly a lot more than we like to think about ourselves. Often you'll find that you don't actually know why you think the things that you think. You just kind of have received them and you follow them. And also we believe we know a lot more about how the world works than we really do. And as soon as you start to scratch the surface, you realize just how little you really understand and how much you just believe other people. Let me give you a simple example. If you ask people, do you know how a helicopter gets lift? Or do you know how a toilet flushes? Or do you know how a zipper works? A lot of people will say, sure, yeah, I can explain those things. I know how those things work. And then you say, okay, go ahead. And then...
like when you asked me to describe a chair.
Yeah. And so as soon as you kind of poke a little bit under the surface, say, okay, go ahead, explain to me how a zipper works. Most people realize that it's a real illusion. They actually have no idea how a zipper works. They can't explain it. They don't know the mechanism. And it's an illusion because they've used a zipper many times, right? So they feel like they know how it works just because they've been exposed to it and they've zipped things up and down a lot. But that doesn't actually mean that they understand the mechanism. But this illusion is extremely pervasive because if you give people this problem, say, okay, explain how a zipper works, and they find that they can't, then you say, you know, actually, we had a different group of people that instead of asking them about a zipper, we asked them about a toilet. Do you think you could have done better at that? And then people say, oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, I know how a toilet works for sure.
Right.
Right. So just because you've been exposed in the very shallow nature of your understanding on one thing doesn't necessarily mean that you immediately say, oh, maybe I don't actually know how a lot of things work. And so a really good way of trying to understand how you really know anything is to talk openly with someone who disagrees with you and try to get to the bottom of why you actually believe the things that you believe.
I almost joked I couldn't disagree more, but I couldn't agree more. That's actually, you know, why I wanted to start a podcast was because I just see so much polarization happening because people are just using words to fight. They're attacking each other with words. They're cutting each other down, and they're just words, but they're creating chemical responses in their brain, in each other's brains. They're literally hurting each other with these words, you know. And it's if they would just grow a pair and talk to somebody who has a different opinion from them, and be prepared to walk away with nothing won, nothing lost, and just for the sake of learning and getting to know somebody else's perspective on the world. And I think the world would be a much better place.
Well, I think there's humility to be gained. So when you actually try to understand how you know the things you know, it'll be a humbling experience about how little you actually know and understand and how at the surface our understanding of the world is. But it's also a really enriching experience to see how many different ways that you could actually see things, right? So for me, seeing all of the different ways that humans around the world have created realities and created ways of thinking is incredibly inspiring. We are a very smart and flexible species. We don't always act that way in the moment, but our brains are actually capable of a whole lot of creativity and ingenuity, a lot more than we give ourselves credit for. And you just have to allow yourself to inhabit that space and see things a little bit differently from the way that you've received seeing them.
Lara, I'm a big fan of the work you're doing. I think it's very important, and I wish you the best in all of your adventures. And as you're trying to spread awareness about this, I think linguistic relativity is super exciting, and I'm excited to see where it takes you.
Thanks so much. It's been a really fun chat.
I couldn't disagree more. I want to encourage everyone to check out Lara's TED Talk. It's called How Language Shapes the Way We Think. It's how I discovered her, and it's quite a fascinating listen, so I highly recommend it. I want to hear your thoughts on today's episode. Be sure to leave a comment, especially if you're watching on YouTube. That's a great place to involve yourself in the conversation. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. That way your phone will always stay up to date. If you want to send me an email, you can do that. hello@spellboundshow.com. I'd love to hear from you. I'm Julian Smith. This has been Spellbound. Look forward to next week. We're talking to Andrew Rader. It's kind of a continuation of the civilization talk we've been doing. Brave New World, the book by Aldous Huxley. Andrew's never read it, and it's been years since I've read it, so we're going through it together. And next week, we're going to be talking about some of the ideas in it. Don't want to miss it. Have a great week. See you guys next Monday.